When you're building a culture of belonging, every word counts. That's why Textio brings the world's most advanced language insights into your hiring and employer brand content. Our industry-leading approach to artificial intelligence and machine learning provides the tools needed to find more diverse candidates. In short, Textio builds more equitable workspaces, guiding businesses and writing more inclusive job posts. And we're building on that success by bringing even more products to the market for all people who share our belief that language matters. Words have power, and at Textio, we harness that power to increase the access and availability of value-driven work for everyone.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to The Access Point, brought to you by Living Corporate. Living Corporate is a digital media network consultancy focused on workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion. Living Corporate centers and amplifies Black and Brown voices in the workplace through digital media production and business-to-business consulting. The network offers a variety of programming, including The Access Point. The Access Point is a weekly webinar focused on preparing Black and Brown aspiring and experienced professionals for the workforce by having the real nuanced talks they don't know they need. During each episode, we examine real challenges you face at work and offer expert advice on dealing with your organization, your boss, your coworkers, and your career. Now, here's the disclaimer. The thoughts and views expressed in tonight's discussion do not reflect the views of any organization with which the hosts or guests may be affiliated. I am Dr. Wendy M. Edmonds. I am an assistant professor and a management consultant and co-author of When Leadership Fails and the author of Intoxicating Followership in the Jonestown Massacre, where my area of research focus is toxic followership. Why do people follow bad people? I'm going to turn it over now to my awesome co-host, Dr. Lonnie Morris.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wendy. It is always exciting to be here as we have these incredible conversations. I'm super excited about this episode and particularly our guests. I am Dr. Lonnie Morris. I'm a management consultant, author, and professor. I spend my time helping really talented and experienced people unpack challenges in organizations to help you hate your job less. This week, we're talking about something I think a lot of you may be able to relate to. We titled this episode, This Job Makes Me Sick. So that today's conversation is going to be literal and figuratively. And to help us do that, we are joined by none other than great friend of mine, mentor and peer, Dr. Angela Costa, who works to bridge the fields of leadership, social justice, and mindfulness. He is a director of the Garrison Institute's Fellowship Program and creative director for the New York City Healing Collective, a community initiative curating work and insights at the intersection of healing, wellness, and societal transformation. As a member of the 400 Years of Inequality Project, he designed the Contemplating 400 Years of Inequality experience to support communities in understanding structural inequality through a contemplative approach. Participating in the Mind and Life Institute's Academy for Contemplative Leadership, Andrew began consulting and developing learning experiences that weave leadership development, inequality, and leaders, particularly educational leaders, through contemplative and restorative practices. It is an honor to have Dr. Angela Costa with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome.
So much. I'm really grateful to be here in this conversation. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you great.
Beautiful.
There's some sort of interference. Go ahead.
Yeah, we can hear you. We can hear you fine. Sound all right?
Yes, yes, I can hear you.
Good, good, good. So this is an interesting week as we think about not just the election, we think about some of the social justice stuff that's happening. We know these things are going on with Kanye West and then basketball players. And so it's had me thinking about what does this look like when all these things play out in the organizations, which is what we talk about here all the time. And it brought me to this thing I saw on LinkedIn earlier, maybe last week. I think it was on the first. And it's called How Trauma in the Workplace Can Stunt Your Career. And I want to start there because your expertise, Dr. Costa, is in healing. But we know if you need healing, there has to be something that causes that, right? So if we think about trauma, and we'll get into that, and particularly in this place, in this piece in LinkedIn, they define trauma as stressful and negative and sometimes disturbing experiences that can affect a person's can affect a person long after the experience has passed. So when we think about that as a backdrop, why in the world do we need healing, and what is it as a response to trauma?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll say that trauma is a very popular topic in this moment, not just because of the current week and month and year, but because of the last few years of enduring a global health crisis where millions of people died and billions of people were impacted by social distance and lockdown protocols. So trauma is something that every single human being in this planet has experienced at some point in their life. And now it becomes a very popular subject to explore in the workplace and in research, in the academic and research community. I want to kind of respond by giving you more context. I studied healing-centered pedagogies at the doctoral level, and that led me to look at some of the research around trauma studies and studying trauma. And there's a really rich history of looking at how different experiences impact people from not just the field of psychology, but also neuroscience, physiology, sociology, and many others. And what we know is that several things. One, that the body keeps the score. The body keeps the score. Mm-hmm. There's a great book right now. You can go buy it. It's called The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Van der Kolk. And in it, he talks about how some of the experiences we have in our lives, at work or outside, that are emotionally draining, that are emotionally toxic, that are psychologically difficult, sometimes they actually become psychosomatic, meaning that they manifest in physical form. One of the greatest examples is the heart attack, that many people sometimes have heart attacks right when they're confronted with reflecting on a convergence of life dilemmas and how that becomes manifested in the body. But more importantly, that when the body keeps a score, that means that it stores your stress in particular places. And, you know, another great example is autoimmune diseases that have emerged and that unfold for people. All of a sudden, you know, you're 40 years old and you're experiencing, you know, autoimmune issues and deficiencies. And what they've seen is that folks end up experiencing all kinds of psychological, emotional stress for decades at work primarily and outside of work. And that causes like physical manifestations.
Yeah.
So trauma can be interpreted in different ways. You know, like I said before, in trauma studies, one of the richest work is understanding, for example, a PTSD, post-traumatic stress. We know so much about soldiers coming back from war. That gave us so much language around what does it mean to experience trauma and then post the experience after it. And we know that I'll end by saying what trauma does is it dysregulates your social, emotional, and nervous system. So the event itself shocks you, and then the memory of it moving forward. So healing, if trauma is dysregulation and disintegration and fragmentation, then healing is integration and grounding. That's a and word. Grounding and centering. And I'm speaking very broadly here because I can go many different directions, talk about healing and trauma, but simplifying it to integration and disintegration might help folks really think about what it means.
So I love that. And I love that you frame this around how we think about trauma in a large sense, particularly with things like war and PTSD. When we think of work trauma, it might show up as your environment. It might be a harassing coworker. There may have been an accident at work. And what we saw in this piece in LinkedIn, it says, and it can impact your career in so many ways. It might show up like stifled creativity. You can't really think through and innovate the way you used to. You might develop a fear of criticism, a loss of confidence, difficulty dealing with people in your team or in your unit. And they may even create this impression, if you're suffering from this trauma that you've experienced at work, this impression that you are cold and maybe even aloof. And so getting to this integration with healing is so significant. And Dr. Winnie, I know you want to chime in on this.
I do. A lot of times you don't recognize the trauma, what caused this thing to happen to you. You are just really caught up in experiencing the outcomes of trauma, the hair loss, the aches and pains, the I'd rather be fishing mentality. Fishing? You know, why does that happen? Because we have real experiences in the workplace where these things happen. Even though we have laws to prevent and protect us at work, people bring behaviors to work that are unbecoming. So when we say bring your best self to work, sometimes that could just look like some people, because the trauma that you're experiencing, repeated trauma, right? It's not like this thing happened one day. It could be an incident that happened one day, but usually the workplace trauma is repeated behavior. You're experiencing this thing over and over again. This coworker continues to harass me. You're seeking help. You're feeling helpless. You're feeling unheard. And so it's that repeat action that you know is not good, but you may not recognize the outcome until they are drastic.
So that's good. And I want to continue with this, because we started with trauma because that's the long-term thing that we want to understand. But I think it's really sort of foundationally looked at as stress, right? We know when you feel stress because of work. We know when I feel stressed out, I feel like I don't want to be there. Dr. Wynn, you said I'd rather be fishing. So there is this study from the American Institute of Stress that just came out this year. And what they said is 83% of the U.S. workers suffer from some type of work-related stress. 25% of them say their job is the number one stressor in their lives, which seems small, but feels very high. About 1 million Americans miss work every day because they feel stressed. 76% of U.S. workers report that the workplace stress affects their personal relationships. More than 50% of the American workers surveyed are not engaged at work the way they used to be because of stress, and it leads to loss of productivity and changes in their personal lives, right? And that they say the main causes of workplace stress come from workload, interpersonal issues, not being able to get along with people, trying to find this inevitable, evasive work-life balance, and then job security. So if we know trauma is long-term, as you mentioned, Dr. Wendy, and it's repetitive, we see it over time. So some of these things we're talking about, that can be happening to you every single day. And so we know that trauma builds from this stress, this long-term stress, and if it's work-induced, but sometimes it might not be about the work itself, right? So it's happening in the environment, but it's not about your job description. It seems like if all these stats are right, we need a much more holistic approach to work. Dr. Acosta, how do we do that? How does healing help us?
How does healing help us, and how do we create a more, you said integrated approach to work?
You said that, but I'll take it.
Well, I want to go back to Dr. Edmund in terms of the repeated experience, the repeated experiences that people may have at work that are traumatic. This is why it's so important to understand the literature and the research on trauma studies. As I said before, that there's this concept of post-traumatic stress. And many of us know that concept because, you know, we may have grown up exposed to, not just in school, but also movies that depicted the war in Vietnam and many other wars in the 20th century, because that research comes out of studying folks who came back from Vietnam and the Gulf Wars, the Gulf War. So PTSD, we know that. Now, what we also know is that there's PSSD, persistent. It's not post, like it happened and you're after, but persistent traumatic stress. So that there is a continuous experience and exposure to really stressful conditions. So just wanted to add that. Dr. Acosta,
just a quick question for you. So what does that look like? Does isolation look like that? Would you say isolation would be that persistent?
I would say that the persistence is the trauma itself, right? So you said one of the examples you gave was a coworker that harasses you, or a coworker that disrespects you. You're in a team, and maybe it's a superior, maybe not, and this person is making work like really difficult for you to the point where you're questioning yourself, your self-worth, your self-esteem, and it's causing some serious work-based trauma. So the persistence is the condition and the situation. I would say that isolation becomes a symptom.
So, okay, I'm sorry. Isolation as a toxic tactic on individuals. Yeah. That's what I meant. I hear you.
Yes, that was what I meant. Isolation can be, depending on... It can be okay. A symptom in somebody who may be experiencing a similar. So, for example, in that specific example of isolation, and the example you gave of a toxic coworker, you know, because of the questioning of your self-esteem and the maybe even belittling of your voice, you begin to not trust your colleagues. Especially colleagues who are close to that colleague who continuously berates you. So you isolate yourself. So isolation becomes a defense mechanism that is a reasonable response to what you're experiencing. But too much of it can be dysfunctional. There's only so much you can isolate yourself in a given team. There's only so much you can isolate yourself in an organization that might need your voice, that might need your feedback, that might need you to respond in particular ways. So that's my response there, sister. That isolation can be a symptom, and I'll you know, since this network is really committed to supporting folks of color, you know, racialized trauma and just racism itself in terms of how people of color can experience it, there are some serious psychological impacts. Some wonderful research has been done on this. The concept that came out in the 2000s was called racial battle fatigue, racial battle fatigue.
Yes.
So in that concept, researchers found that people of color spend a lot of time just really defending their self-worth in especially predominantly white spaces. And that there comes with it a fatigue of telling people, you know, don't touch my hair, or this is how you pronounce my name, and yes, I can speak, I'm well spoken, I'm not sure why you have to remind me of that.
Come on now.
You know, so that defending, and those are like microaggressions. We're not just talking about, we're not talking yet about
that's right,
being overlooked, your resume being set aside because your name is too black, or your last name is Muhammad. You know, those are larger systemic issues.
If they want to minimize your name to a nickname because they don't want to pronounce your whole name.
Exactly. So all of that, what I wanted to say is that it causes a sense of deep fatigue. And then a byproduct of that fatigue can be isolation, can be hyper reactivity. Right. So in a hyper impulsiveness, always kind of being ready to needing to defend oneself. What some psychologists call hypervigilance. So always being on the lookout of people trying to play you, people trying to disrespect you, or, you know, so that email that the team sent and didn't CC you, it's not just the email that you were not CC'd in. It's like, you're trying to undermine me. I'm part of this team, part of the project.
Absolutely.
Right. So, ooh. Yeah. So just some thoughts there around my response to Dr. Edmund, and then, you know, some comments around healing. Again, it's really about integration. And if you're in a workspace that is causing a lot of dysregulation or traumatic experiences, and you haven't found the right supports yet inside of that organization, you know, the next step is to find a support outside of that organization, whether it be in the form of therapy or discussion groups, support groups. And then the healing comes from making space to process the experience and making sense of how the experience has changed you and how the changes you've made that may have not been productive, like being too isolating, need to change. Whether you stay in that job or not, what is true is that it is a legitimate experience that has caused particular impact on your behavior, and that behavior is not helping you.
I love that so much. I love that what we want everyone to understand is recognize that you've experienced this, acknowledge that, and then be intentional about processing of it. This is really important. So I think individuals have accountability in this, right? Self-care, once you acknowledge that it's happening, self-care is important. But I think even the recognition of it sometimes is difficult for people to realize I'm suffering from this type of trauma, particularly this persistent trauma that we're talking about. But it's not always just the individual, not just the employee that's suffering or the employee that's responsible. Leaders have some responsibility in this too, even if they aren't the perpetrators, right? So if you are responsible for leading someone and managing a team of people, and someone or multiple people on your team have experienced some type of stress that we're talking about or type of trauma, you're still responsible for helping them get through that. I saw this in the Journal of Organizational Change Management earlier, I think 2 months ago, and they looked at this concept of emotional healing as it relates to organizational innovation. And so the idea of emotional healing is described as taking care of followers' emotions and playing a proactive role by listening, supporting, and providing guidance to those who suffer or who have suffered traumatic experiences at work. Now, I love this because they actually interview people at organizations that were on the greatest places to work list. So they found the places that people are saying, this is the space I love. And what they found is that when they saw emotional healing practice, there was a positive effect on organizational learning capacity, so how the organization grows, not just individually, and that the organizational learning capacity positively affected how innovative the people were and the organization as a whole. So my question to both of you, and Dr. Wendy or Dr. Acosta, you can jump in, either one. If we know that leaders have responsibility, or at least they need to be accountable, what must they do? And what is the reasonable expectation for us? So if I've been traumatized by someone else and it's not the person who I currently report to, what's the reasonable expectation of that person to help me to heal?
Yes, Dr. Edmund, anything on your end first?
Well, you know, I'm thinking that the leaders often will recognize the behavior of employees, not necessarily what's causing that behavior. They recognize the behavior. And so if we're, as leaders, should provide the safe space for our employees to have the conversation and to know that once they have the conversation, not only are they heard, but that something is going to take place to promote healing in the workspace. Now, we know that there are laws that may, well, they do give guidance as to how you're supposed to handle it, but there's a human side to this as well. Yeah. There's a human side, mm-hmm, where it's not always a surprise to the leaders. Leaders, right, they know, they understand this isn't the first time.
Yeah.
It forces them to be accountable as a leader, to act as a leader, or are they going to be the toxic follower and follow what everyone else has done, which is ignore it. So I think there's a responsibility for leadership to create that whole safe space, which is what we call, you know, we refer to as a psychological safety in the workplace for our employees to have the conversations. And I also wanted to say that when the behavior shows up, if it is dealt with immediately, you don't get the red flags that you talked about earlier, where it affects the productivity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you have your pulse on your employees, you know when they're having a bad day, when they're having a bad time, and you know when they've had a bad life on that job.
A bad life. You know what? I have an example of this. I was speaking with a client just maybe a week or so ago who had a stressful situation that turned into a trauma experience in the workplace with just differences of opinion, and it turned into where he thought he was just sharing his disagreement about a process, and it turned into being really demonized for it. And what he told me, he says, I went into isolation for a whole year. And this was still during pandemic time. So whenever we had meetings, never put my camera on, didn't volunteer for any additional assignments, only came to things that were required, not the optional things that I could take out of. And what he said is, and nobody on the leadership team said anything to me about it. For the whole year, just went into a cocoon.
And nobody said anything.
Nobody said anything.
Mm-hmm.
That is not emotional healing, right? That is not the proactive intentionality that we're talking about here. Dr. Acosta, what are your thoughts?
My contribution here is being able to put this in slightly broader context in terms of, like, why are we in this conversation in the first place at this point? I'll say a couple things about the two stories that you two have shared. You know, leaders who either ignore or fail to tend to the emotional landscape of their organizations will have to deal with them regardless in the form of scandals and lawsuits.
Say that again.
Come on. Right now. Scandal.
So, at worst, you know, in other cases, it's, you know, it'd be conflict mediation. And I say conflict mediation on purpose because what I want you to, and what I want the community to listen to is that we have more tools now in the form of words. So like emotional intelligence, safe space, psychological safety, you know, trauma, healing, PTSD, PTSD. We have more language now to talk about the ways in which sometimes our workspaces aren't safe, aren't conditions, aren't set up to, for us to thrive. But this has been a very long-standing problem. It's just that now we have some new language that can support us with addressing it. You know, what we can typically, the conversation we're having 20, 30, 40, 100 years ago, it would have just manifested as conflict.
Yeah.
The need for conflict resolution. In every organization, there's rupture. In every organization, there's trauma. It's just that now, I think the pandemic expedited this. Remember during the pandemic, not only are we going through a pandemic, but all of a sudden people are marching in the streets, you know, in response to the murder of Black life.
Yeah.
Public, right? So all of a sudden, like, organizations are, many of them are remote, but then their employees are like, yo, we need to address this. And and not only are Black people being murdered in the streets, but in this very organization, there's anti-Blackness. So
anti-Blackness right here in my office.
Yeah, so yeah, no. So what I wanted to say with that is that organizations and its leaders have been forced to more than ever tend to the emotional life of their employees. And sometimes that life includes difficult emotions that are being experienced outside. I remember when there were some serious waves of Asian hate crimes throughout the country, still to this day.
Yeah.
The AIP community was feeling it in the organizations that I was working in. It was difficult. You know, I knew some women who in New York City didn't feel safe to go in the subway. Right. How do you navigate those feelings when your employers don't feel safe coming into work because the commute feels unsafe and you're trying to mandate a back to work policy?
It's tone deaf, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very rich moment, you know. Even though like the theme of this conversation is when work makes you sick, the promise of it is that in having more language to talk about that sickness, you can actually find an antidote because you get a chance to name what's happening and find resources to allow you to find either healing, restoration, space. You know, all kinds of, you know, different resources, whether it be in the organization that you're embedded in now or outside of it.
Some leaders also had to respond to their employees because they were holding them accountable on their policies that tell us where you stand on this issue. So what's happening in the streets, what I deal with every day going home in my community is now on national television. Where do you stand? Some of this, you know, these actions forced leaders and organizations to take a stance, to do something. They could no longer sit and be quiet. And so healing looked different in the workplace. Healing was, okay, how can we help to do something to support the cause? How do we do that? They held them accountable for that.
So this is interesting, right? Holding organizations accountable, holding leaders accountable. And so I saw this other study in a journal called Work, and this was just in September. And they were doing this inquiry around victims of workplace bullying. And some of them were self-reported or clinically diagnosed with depression, anxiety, panic disorder, social phobia, and there was one other thing. So anyway, they had sort of this experiment where they put them through treatment. And they had a control group. So some people did not get this, I think it was like 10 weeks of therapy sessions, and others did. Here's what they found. Two things I thought were pretty interesting to me, that there was no significant effect of age or gender on the treatment and the outcome. So that no matter what your age was, or if you were your gender identity, woman or man, or other, it didn't impact what we see in the results, which was the detrimental effects of experiencing workplace bullying, the trauma that they experienced from that, did not disappear unless they were treated. So if you just experienced it and went home, as we talked about, in isolation, or you were isolated from your group from that way and never got to talk through it, never got to work on it, never got to put some strategies in place, nothing ever happened. But people who actually got help because it was identified, as you said, Dr. Acosta, it was named, they found at least the beginning of resemblance of an antidote, right? We started working on it. So my question here is, if we know data tells us this, when people experience these things, there's got to be some work done. How do we get that work?
Yeah, and I'll say that what part of what you're naming of the benefit of finding the resources to name and to process difficult experiences, and the benefit of that, part of that's called cognitive reframing. Cognitive reframing, and by that is, you ever learn a word and it describes something you've been feeling a really long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like for example,
that word was cognitive reframing.
Yeah. I'll give you a very brief example. Like I come from the Dominican Republic, but my people are mixed. We have Black, we have Spaniard, we have Taino, we have particularly in my family, like we are melanated for real. So for a long time, like I was like, what? Like I'm Dominican, but growing up, in my college years, like I am part of the Black diaspora. So when the term Afro Latino came into the scene, I was like, what? That's me, so that cognitive reframing is so helpful, because in that example I found a home, I found a sense of healing. I'm like, oh my god, I don't have to be these two things, or these multitudes. I can just this is a identity wise this is a place I can kind of, or a concept I can use to really identify myself, at least with my own self and in my community. But why we don't get access, I mean, a lot of times people just don't know the resources that are out there for them. Sometimes they're in the organization that they're in, there aren't resources to address conflict or to address mental health.
How about trust?
Let's start there.
I know. How about just stop treating me like this? But, so as far as like why people struggle is a variety of reasons. They might not have examples of people who have gotten help, and the stigma of mental health and therapy in our community. I don't need counseling. I don't need therapy. There is that kind of trope in many of our communities. We come from peoples who have been forced to work, have been forced for generations to deal with the structural conditions that constantly extracted our value, extracted our labor, extracted our culture. So there's some serious internalized, what some may call oppression, that can lead to a sense of helplessness and nihilism, you know. But I'm an optimist a prisoner of hope, as Dr. Cornel West says. And I think we have more language now. We have more language now to talk about intergenerational trauma. We have more language with which to talk about burnout at work and stress at work, and how the body keeps the score. So that's all, you know, cause to be excited about this moment.
I love it. Dr. Wendy.
I totally agree with Dr. Acosta. There's words that describe what you feel, and there is no surprise that when you find out, it's a sense of relief.
Mm-hmm. It's just it's not just me.
Yeah, it's a total sense of relief. And you're looking for, okay, now that I found this thing out, now that I know what it's called, now that I know that it's real, how do I get help? And where do I go for help?
Yeah.
On the job, in the workplace. So you know what this is now, because you could seek therapy and they tell you all about it and help you to understand and put strategies, but then you have to go back to work.
So I'm sorry to laugh. Because
it's real.
It's a sad reality,
mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm laughing at the ridiculousness of it, right? That I've got to go back to the place that is causing all this harm, and as we started out, and Dr. Costa said, it can show up, and I know I've experienced it. I've experienced being so stressed that I was going to physical therapy every week because what it was showing up as something in my joints, and so it was just this pain, this ache that wouldn't go away. And the doctors kept running tests, right? Well, it's not this. We'll try this other intervention. It's not that. We're going to let you do this type of therapy. That didn't work. And it wasn't until I left the job when it went away.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
So let's try this. Because I looked at something from the Center for Care Innovations, and this was probably earlier last year in 2021, and they have this list of the 10 things that employees should look out for if you are interested in, or at least considering, could this be a healing, particularly a healing organization, or particularly an organization that is moving towards the path of healing justice. So I've got this list, and there are some things I think are really great, some things we talked about already, but there are a few things I want to highlight very specifically. Because you already mentioned, they say create that the organization creates space for reflection. So we talked about that. They also note that you should look for organizations that welcome curiosity, both internally and externally, right? That it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to push the envelope. That they encourage accountability in group discussions. That you can't just say something and leave it there. That you have to unpack these types of things that are happening. But here's the one, and they mentioned this idea of integrated perspectives that you talked about, Dr. Acosta. Here's the one that stuck with me. And I'll give you this, and I want to think through, are there some other things that we're missing here? This one I love. It says, what is learned here leaves here. What is said here stays here. Mm-hmm. Let me give you that again. What is learned here leaves here. What is said here stays here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're going to create healing organizations. We have to be able to take what we learn from each other, the new knowledge we create, the language that we get, and move that out into the community so everyone benefits from that. But when people share their trauma, share their stress, share their issues, share their conflict, we can't then marginalize them for sharing that. We can't demonize them for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
So what else should we have on this list of creating healing and healing justice organizations?
Again, I want to say that it's an interesting moment historically, because you have the emergence of such a list. You know, so it's I just want people to understand the richness of this moment where we would have such a list that would support us with thinking about, you know, what could a healing-centered organization look like. You know, that question around what other organizational behaviors or values that enable healing, what other, you know, we could talk about that. But I think for me was slightly a more interesting question is, what is it about organizations that makes it so difficult to sustain conditions for thriving
and for repair? You didn't hit the thing. What is it? Cognitive reframing? You just did it again.
Remix? No. So that's, I appreciate your question, but I think that there's a sub question here that invites some interesting thinking around organ. Because, like, for example, like I've been in the game enough to see all kinds of different organizations. Let's say like an organization founded by a visionary founder and a charismatic leader. And like the first several years, it's like, it's everybody's just jazzed from the vision and the funding and the resources. And, you know, all of a sudden there's some scaling that happens and, you know, some shifts in the organization in terms of expansion. And all of a sudden we're just different.
See it all the time. Yep.
There's just things start to change. You know, new people come in with different values. The original founder or founders are struggling to continue the vision in terms of in relation to the changes that are happening. And enough change happens that you don't have that original organization that was able to be healing centered, that was able to be restorative, that was able to handle crisis as it emerged. Now you just have something else, and I'm intrigued by that something else. What happens?
Wow.
There's also costs associated with and you allude to this, Dr. Acosta. There are costs associated with healing, promoting healing on the job. And one of the things that comes to mind is when the president of the university realized that, you know, 2 years of a pandemic, what people had been going through and still continuing to work, hard, the loss of people and through COVID meant that, good news, you have a job, because there were people who lost their jobs during the pandemic, you know, that were still in. And good news is you kept your job, but you have to do the job of more than one person now. And it was Thanksgiving, and we normally don't have a whole week. You know, it all starts that day before Thanksgiving. But what...
I'm traumatized by that. I'm sorry. That's persistent over the years.
And what happened is that in realizing what that was, the kickoff to the full week holiday that was experienced that we had never had before was a full day of wellness. If you showed up on campus, it was all about you. It started, I mean, you just had multiple activities, nature walks, working out. The gym was open. They had people who did massages to come in. Everywhere you went, there was some sort of a gift for you, you know, throughout the entire day. This was what would be a normal 8-hour work day. They had games. They had movies. It was laid out. It had never been done before. And I didn't understand why the news, like, where's the media? Have you ever heard of that?
Wellness is not newsworthy. Didn't you know that?
No. No one shared that. And that sentiment continued throughout the year to thank employees every time they do something, because it is extraordinary. You're asking them to go above and beyond to show that you appreciate them. What does that look like? And so there were just different activities throughout the year to show that. I tell you, I was amazed. I was also very happy. But then there's a part of me that says, what's going to make that change?
How do we move it? How do we keep pushing it? Mm-hmm. So this is good. I love that you're bringing this idea of sort of this day of celebration of wellness and then carrying that forward, because as Dr. Acosta mentioned, and forces us to think about, why are organizations having such a challenge with this? So this is something that I came across that it's pretty interesting. It's along the same lines of, how do we rethink this? And I imagine, at least I don't think about this a lot, but I don't think we talk enough about what your space means to your own healing, right? So your workspace and your personal space. So this is, I didn't even know there was a journal for this, Journal of Corporate Real Estate. In the middle of the pandemic, did a study on creating healthy offices. How about that? And it said, if you improve the physical workspace with intentionality, so these are their findings, relative to connectedness, teamwork, sustainability, and what they found is that employees' feelings of comfort and energy increase substantially. And this idea of this design concept was around having healthy food available, providing space for physical activity, like you just mentioned, Dr. Wendy, bringing light into the rooms where people work, creating space for people to connect regularly. I love this one. Giving people a sense of ownership of the space so they can bring their own things, or they can add to it, or they can take from it, or you create all these things. So you can control what you want the space to look like. Your team can. So if we know that we aren't thinking about these things regularly, what can we recommend, or what should people do as they're listening to this and thinking through it? What are the small steps I can take if I can't get my organization, if I'm not willing or ready to pay the cost for trying to move us to organizational healing? What can I do in my own space to help change this, to get us closer to a healing justice organization? What does that look like, Dr. Acosta?
Yeah, my own space. And by own space, you mean myself or my space in the organization?
You tell me. Let's do both. So you're talking about physical space and personal space.
You know,
for example,
like if there is an experience you're having that at work, whether it's been prolonged or just started, that is just really difficult, whatever way it is, to the point where it makes it difficult to just go into work. First thing you need to start doing is grounding yourself before work. So often, you know, we just get up and get ready and go into another day, but there is something to readying oneself for battle, readying oneself for the work. And
Did you say battle? Okay.
He did say battle. Dr. Acosta is on the war. He just brought up all the wars. He's a soldier. He's a prisoner of hope. We get it.
That's funny.
But it is a war, right? So I appreciate the metaphor. Absolutely.
No, yeah. So readying oneself for the day and for the intensity that's going to bring. Because if the experience at work already is, as I said before, traumatic and dysregulating, then you're meeting dysregulation with dysregulation.
Just blew my mind right there.
If you're entering the day with grounded, open, contemplative understanding and space of just like, you know, I'm in my body. I just did my practice, you know, I ate well and I'm just going in. There's less of what's called a weathering effect on your mind and body from the onslaught of whatever stressful activity you're experiencing. you have literally more neurochemicals firing for you in terms of dealing with the experience. So readying oneself before work. Also, again, we've discussed it, finding resources to talk to somebody about the work beyond someone who can just hear you vent.
We have a lot of vent listeners, right?
You need somebody or some kind of group that can hear you vent, but then can like mirror back to you, like, this is what I hear. And then also can reframe what you're experiencing in different ways. Some of us might have friendships like that, but most of us don't have skilled friends who can really do that work. That's mostly sometimes therapists do. And then at work, you know, just really, as opposed to isolating yourself from everyone, look at who are the people who you might be able to slightly lean on most. It's not like you need to be chummy or best friends, but, you know, you just don't want to create a situation at work where you can't talk to anybody about something, or you can't really connect with others at work. So just really kind of, as things are unfolding, just really finding opportunities to build genuine relationships with your teammates, and as much as you can, and to self-advocate for yourself, you know, set boundaries with your employers around, you know, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to that meeting. You know, I'm not going to that retreat. You know, that person is going to be there. Or, you know, I mentioned before, this was a difficult thing for me and you didn't do anything, so I'm sorry. Of course, setting boundaries. Last thing I'll say, sometimes setting boundaries may lead to leaving you vulnerable. Because you might set a boundary that your employer just doesn't rock with, you know, so then your very employment is in question.
Yeah.
And then you have to decide, is this the kind of organization you want to be part of?
Mm-hmm. Or is that your fight? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or is that your fight?
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. So when we look at this whole spectrum of experiencing stress that leads to long-term trauma, and how we start to think about healing, here are the things that we gathered today. For employees, I love how we started this. Recognize that the body keeps score. So if you are continuing to take this weathering, that it will show up and manifest in multiple ways, in physical ways, in psychological ways, that will distress you even further than you could imagine. Remember that isolation can be both a defense mechanism, but also it can be a detriment to your health. That there's this idea of racial battle fatigue. So if you are feeling tired and exhausted because you're constantly having to defend your worth and your value, and that is a real thing, so you are not alone, and that does exist. Make space to process. Make space to understand how you're processing and how it has changed you. Ground yourself before work. Get ready for the day, and Dr. Costa said, for the war, because you cannot fight dysregulation with dysregulation. For leaders in these spaces, understand that trauma is disintegration, and that you cannot ignore that, and that healing is the opposite. The antidote is integration. That the best self that you ask people to show up with for some is not the same best self for all. Workplace trauma is repeated behavior, so you need to recognize that and acknowledge that and help people identify help and sources for healing. Recognize that isolating someone is a toxic stressor, so if that is your approach to dealing with conflict, pay attention and provide space for conversation when people are stressed and are experiencing trauma. Don't pretend that you are surprised, because it is your role as a leader and a management organization to be in tune with that. And emotional healing requires your proactive intention. When you name what is happening, you can find the antidote. So if you help people identify, here's what you're experiencing, you can also help them then combat that experience. And I love this one. This was the big learn for me today, recognizing that cognitive framing is the beginning of healing. When you're able to name the thing, you can help people heal the thing. For groups and teams, remember that what is learned here leaves here, and what is said here stays here. There is an accountability that you have to your teammates, to your work, to your coworkers, to your organization, to your unit, of processing through issues, but also protecting people's concerns that they've shared. Develop or join groups that allow you to mirror your experiences, so you can share, here's what's happening, and they can help you reflect and process. At the organizational level, persistent trauma stress is continuous exposure to stress, and some of your organizations are causing that. Integration is the key. Find support inside and outside of the organization for employees and help them move towards healing space. If you ignore it, this is another gem from Dr. A. If you ignore it, it will end up in scandal or a lawsuit. So this is a part of not just protecting employees as you should, but also protecting the organization. Figure out why your organization is having a problem with moving in direction of healing. That shouldn't be an issue. Recognize that the cost people experience associated with trying to move you into a healing space can be detrimental, and protect people from that. And I love this, Dr. Wendy. Everything is extraordinary, no matter how small. So celebrate and help that, help people continue on a path to wellness through those practices. So if we take all that into consideration today, Dr. Angela Costa, Dr. Wendy, if people don't listen to anything we said, what is the black tax that they pay? What is the cost for not paying attention, for not heeding this advice? Dr. Costa.
More trauma. More unprocessed trauma. Trauma will be something you'll experience for the rest of your life. Suffering is the object of the human condition, but unprocessed suffering, that turns into agony. And I'm not sure people out there want to live that.
I love that. Dr. Wendy.
I hope that this information is valuable and that everyone would take heed, because the life you save may be your own.
I love that. Mm-hmm. And what I think about immediately is when we posted that this episode was going to be tonight, someone commented on Instagram and said, the title for this episode is "This Job Makes Me Sick." The comment was, "That's the story of my life. That is not the story you want for your life." We appreciate you. Thank you so much, Dr. Costa, for sharing your wisdom and your brilliance with us. It is always a pleasure to be in your presence. Dr. Wendy, you are an amazing co-host, and it is definitely my honor to sit beside you during these spaces, during these times. For all of you who are listening, either live with us or in the podcast, thank you for your time and always sharing this space with us. This is The Access Point. If you want to connect with Living Corporate, here are all of our socials. On the web, we are livingcorporate.tv. On Twitter, we are at Living Corporate. LinkedIn, we are living-corporate. Instagram, we are at Living Corporate. And you can listen to The Access Point wherever you get your podcasts. Like, comment, share, subscribe. If you want to join us live, we are in Twitter Spaces every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Living Corporate is brought to you by Doximity. Over 90% of graduating medical students join Doximity to use our tools before earning their doctoral degree. As medicine's largest network, there's an elevated level of responsibility to everything we do. We don't take that responsibility lightly and are committed to working towards a more equitable world inside and beyond our virtual office walls. If you want to learn more about Doximity, make sure you go to your app store, type in DOXIMITY. That's DOXIMITY.